Welcome to The Read-Along,
a mini book club for your ears.
I'm your host, Scott.
I'm your other host, Anita.
And join us on a journey through a good book,
one chapter at a time.
Do you like talking about movies? Do you like talking about mediocre movies? Do you like talking about how you could have fixed mediocre movies? Well, I certainly do, and you can listen to me, Scott C. Bourgeois, along with my co-hosts Greg Beaver and Liam Creswick, as we give our notes, and I have some notes. You can follow it now on your podcatcher of choice or support it by visiting patreon.com/ihavesomenotes. Blustery days.
Very.
It's been terribly windy the last few days.
Last like 3 days?
Yeah.
Give or take? Like crazy windy.
Yeah.
Yeah, my allergies are going to kill me.
Our son has been complaining about the noise as well. Like before going to bed, he's like, I'm not going to be able to sleep through this.
It's loud. Like sometimes a good gust comes through and it is loud.
Yeah. Like rattling the fixtures loud.
Yeah.
Like it's been fierce the last couple days and cool. Like, the temperature is, on paper, nice, but the wind is still, like, an Arctic wind.
So yeah, it's still cold.
It cuts. It's really cool.
Because we can't have nice spring around here.
We've never had a nice spring. Spring
Not
is,
ever.
And I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, the worst season. At least where
here,
we live.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's muddy, and it's cool, and it's gross.
Yeah, there's usually snow, because spring isn't really spring, it's just winter not letting go.
It's this weird transition between the end of winter and the beginning of summer that has no, like, gradation to it.
Not here, no.
No. Like, some places I'm sure spring is lovely, but here it's just like winter, 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 summer.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Summer tries to come in with warm weather, and winter goes, no! And then it snows again, or it's super cold, and everything's brown and dry, and there's snow mold. It's just, spring is not great here.
No, it's bad, and it's awful. Summer is nice. Fall is nice. Winter is nice.
It can be nice. Sometimes winter is very harsh.
But not spring.
Not spring.
Spring can take a hike.
I'm sure other places have lovely springs. Not here.
Yeah, well, hopefully summer gets to it soon enough. Our son has been just desperate to wear shorts.
I know. Both of our kids, super keen on summer wear.
And it's just like, it's still rather cool. He insisted on wearing shorts today, and we got to school so I could drop him off. And it was like, that wind is cold. I hope that you are okay with it, because you insisted on wearing shorts.
Well, they need to learn to live with their decisions.
It's true. I'm sure he'll be fine. He wasn't the only one there wearing shorts.
So, okay. At least yeah. He's not alone.
At any rate, we should segue into our story.
Yes, let's talk about our book.
With a brief recap of our previous chapter, which would have been chapter 17, in which Cornelia takes a moment to apologize for Beckett and kind of finally explain how the two of them became friends in the first place.
Yes.
And then we go to a fairy funeral where Mallory and Diana are able to corner Gray Quinn and get a couple answers out of him, which may give him an alibi for some of the murders. And that basically leads us into chapter 18 of The Undetectables by Courtney Smith. So one thing that we neglected to mention right at the end of last episode, actually, is that at the tail end of Ben's funeral, Felix hands them the CCTV footage from the club the night of the murder.
Right, right.
So they have that, but they haven't had a chance yet to investigate it.
Yeah, they haven't had a chance to do anything about it.
Because the next day, they've set up an appointment with the Nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah, they want an opportunity to actually question Van Doren a little bit because they haven't had the chance to yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cornelia and Mallory are off to see the Nightmare.
And what an interesting experience this is.
Yeah, first of all, Mallory considers that this is an opportunity to come clean about the tiny murder that she committed.
Yep.
But admits to herself that she's a total coward and can't bring herself to do it.
Yep.
And she's cognizant of the fact that the longer she fails to apologize for it, the worse it's going to be.
Yes.
When Cornelia figures out what's happened.
Yep.
but just,
I know,
just can't
it's
do it.
Just, it's just hanging there over Mallory the whole time, and she is too scared to say anything.
Yep.
And it's going to suck.
Yeah.
It's going to suck extra hard. Well, we'll get there.
Yep.
Not in this chapter, but I'm sure we'll get there.
No. And Mallory has made the interesting choice of bringing Cornelia with her to see Van Doren, a person who hates him.
Yep.
I think that maybe the logic here is that they can kind of good cop, bad cop him a little bit.
Maybe.
And Mallory's initial play, like she even admits to herself when they get there, to get a little ahead of ourselves, like she's going to play to his ego a little bit to put him off guard.
Yeah.
Before Cornelia puts her foot in it.
Exactly. And Mallory intends to lead this interview, right, to prevent Cornelia from putting her foot in it.
And Cornelia is all for it, but can't
help
herself.
No.
No.
And Mallory quickly loses control of the situation.
Yeah.
Like, quickly, quickly.
To back up a little bit, they make their way to Van Doren's office down the impossibly long creepy corridor. Jacob pops his head out of his office and is like, "Hey, buddies. How you doing?"
Like, weirdly friendly.
Yep. "Sorry about your friend. Was really, really sad at the funeral. Gotta go. The phone's ringing. Not much of a phone person myself. Prefer letters, but gotta go answer that."
"Thanks for the awkward interaction, Jacob. Okay, bye."
Yeah. And then they go to Van Doren's office, and after a moment, he gruffly invites them in.
Yeah.
And this interview goes interestingly.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So either Van Doren is completely unhinged all the time, or something is up.
Oh, something's up. And we're gonna put a pin in that.
I know. We're going to get there.
And I'm going to start that off with an important clue.
Yes.
That is understated in this particular chapter, which is that Mallory notes that he's not wearing the gaudy green ring that he was wearing the first time they met with him.
Yep.
And it clicks that she had noticed something off when she ran into him at the Larix the night of the murder. Mm-hmm. And she realizes now he wasn't wearing the ring then either. And it was such an obvious gaudy piece of jewelry that it stood out
like
in that
really
first meeting.
Yeah, it really stood out,
And that's a very important clue that we're going to come back to shortly.
Yes. So they go in under the guise of being journalists, I assume, because they keep talking about this article that they're writing.
They actually don't go in with that guise. They just kind of like pick up on a little bit of his assumption of what's going on. Because he acts like he's never spoken to them before.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "What are you here? Are you like journalists? What's going on?" And they just kind of lean into that. And they're like, "Yes, we
yes,
are here
absolutely,
writing an
sir.
Article. That is what is happening."
Yes. Smile and nod. Yes.
Indeed.
Yeah. So they go in under this guise that he has given them, I guess. It's a very unusual situation by the end.
Yeah. Well, he's not super forthcoming with answers. He is willing to kind of play along as they ask, like, "So what were you doing October 2nd? We were under the impression that you were at another one of the Quinn hotel openings." And he confirms, "Yes, I was there with my partner. Pretty sure I was there all night."
Yeah.
Not 100%, but pretty sure.
Yeah. And then, unfortunately, this is almost immediately where Mallory loses control of what's going on. And Cornelia steps in and lets her rage drive these questions.
Not even her rage. She can't help but needle him about the age of his partner.
Her disdain, I guess, then.
Which, I mean, Cornelia, on the one hand, it's a little creepy when an older man is with a younger woman. But they are both consenting adults.
Yeah,
it's not like he's dating a 16-year-old.
No, I know. But it's still, the point is that it's Cornelia who's clearly upset and like does not care for this man, like throwing things at him. Like, she basically, without using so many words, accuses him of being power hungry and asks him to justify himself.
Yeah.
With that. Right? Like,
which,
what are you doing?
In fairness, he does kind
yes,
of
he like he does
he f- straight up admits that he's nakedly power hungry. He's just like, I want power in this community. I want power in this community so that I can help this community. Those in power should use their power to do that. And on the one hand, a little altruistic, on the other hand, somewhat selfish. And he also kind of explains the reasoning behind the for-profit prison, where he's like, look, a culture, are not just Racton, but all of a culture at the moment is mostly just like a tourist trap for the appearance.
Yep.
Like, they come here and they get to experience some magic and some fairies, and then that's it. I'm trying to prove that our community, specifically, and our whole culture in general has more to offer an integrated world. We could do business here. We could attract more business here as more than just an oddity for people to come and gawk at. And he kind of has a point.
He does. And the unfortunate thing is, I think the Undetectables are going to use that against him.
Oh, they 100% are.
Even though in this moment, I don't think that his intentions are bad.
Well, I'm willing to go so far as to say they are definitely self-motivated, but he's got at the very least a convincing pitch that his self-motivation, his self-interest could help everybody else too.
Yes. It's sort of a weird situation.
Yeah.
For him, like, admitting that he is what they think he is, but not for the reasons they might think he is.
Yeah, and it definitely doesn't really add up to a murderous motive.
No, not necessarily.
No.
Although I'm sure if you twist it the right way, maybe?
Like, they certainly read it as, well, he just admitted that he wants power, and what better way to gain power than to finish this ritual and summon the Turnian? But that's not what he's stating he wants to do.
No, right?
And while he could be lying...
Everybody could be lying.
Why? He comes across as weirdly honest in this chapter.
Yeah, right?
Like, cagey, but the information he provides seems on the level for the most part, even though both of the girls are deeply suspicious of him.
Of course.
And by the end of the chapter, Mallory's kind of made up her mind that he's probably the prime suspect.
Yeah, and I really agree with you. I don't think it's Van Doren.
No.
We'll
get to that.
I know.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
We are. And then this is where it gets a little crazy for me, because there's no knowing nod. There's no knowing wink. He genuinely tells them, like, to stay away from this case, and he didn't hire them.
He acts through this entire chapter, and indeed, he acted this way at the Larynx,
yes,
the night of the murder, like he has no clue who these people are.
Right? So either he's crazy overselling the secrecy of it, or more likely, the Van Doren that hired them wasn't the real Van Doren.
You've gotten ahead of the plot here.
But, I'm sorry.
But yes, that is
it is what it looks like.
The way that Mallory decides to read this is that he is concerned that he's being watched, and he did hire them under very, like, DL sort of circumstances.
Yes.
And it clicks for her that she's using them as deniable assets, so that if the investigation goes the way he wants, he can claim victory by having hired these super great investigators. And if it points in the direction he doesn't want, he can disavow them.
Yeah.
And Mallory is particularly devastated by this, because while Cornelia and Diana are well positioned enough that they can survive having their reputations dragged through the mud by Van Doren,
she can't.
She can't. She's no. done if that happens. And it actually fills her with some righteous indignation. And I feel like that helps drive her towards the idea that they're going to nail Van Doren to the wall for this.
She is certainly motivated to solve these murders.
Yes.
By the time they leave the office. Like I said before, I don't think they've got the right guy, though.
No, they don't. One last piece of information, though, before we move on.
Mm.
He does also appear to have an alibi for the murder at the Larynx, which is that he was at home with his partner at the time.
Yes.
And then went to the club when he heard there had been a murder.
Yeah, because he got called because there was a murder. Yeah.
Because there was a murder. And that's basically him laying out his alibi for both.
More or less.
Yeah. Flimsy alibi, but possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He has a better alibi for October 2nd.
Yeah.
Because he was with a bunch of people, right?
It's true. And the girls decide as they leave that not only is Van Doren acting super suspicious and therefore possibly trying to hide that he hired them to cover the fact that he's the murderer, but also that they're going to go and finally test that last bit of DNA and check out the CCTV footage.
Yes.
So
actually look at their evidence and see what they've got.
Well, now that they've had a chance to talk to everybody, yes.
Yeah.
And that leads us over here.
I've gathered you all here in the accusing parlor.
J'accuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm opening up the accusing parlor.
Ah, here we go.
You'll note I've already dusted off the furniture and
taken
the sheets off. I've lit a nice roaring fire.
Oh, it's lovely.
Made sure the ominous grandfather clock is...
ticking loudly.
Ticking loudly, yeah. And I just want to say, Jacob Gabbett, j'accuse!
It's official. an official accusation. You've done it.
Yes. I think that they were not hired by the nightmare. I think that ring was some sort of disguise magic. And I think they were hired by Jacob. He is either using them to frame up the nightmare or just to muddy up the investigation long enough for him to finish his ritual. We've already laid out tons of other circumstantial evidence, but this is damning. They were originally approached by him via mail.
Yep.
They were taken by him to meet the nightmare the first night. He took them to the door.
Yep.
He disappeared. And then several minutes later, the nightmare called them in, wearing this big green ring that he has not worn since.
Yep.
And he doesn't appear to recognize them at all in this chapter or at the club when Mallory approaches them. He outright states in this chapter, I would never hire a bunch of rank amateurs to muddy up an official investigation into something this important. How even dare you suggest I would? I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's covering his butt.
No, I don't think he is either. I think something is up.
I think Jacob was masquerading as him. And again, if it's a magic item that's doing it, like this ring, and he was provided with an inventory of all the magic items that were at the mayor's office, an apparent can do it. And what's one of the first things that the nightmare says to them when they go and get hired by him?
Mm.
This is an occult murder. It is 100% done by an occult person. You should only be investigating occult people.
Well, he doesn't say it exactly like that, but yeah.
Basically.
More or less. And they go with it. They agree. They're like, yeah, this was a magical murder. So clearly it was done by an occult person.
Jacob keeps sticking his nose in their business and keeps approaching them like he's familiar with them.
Yep.
He, however, can't offer them any assistance whatsoever, despite the fact that they were hired by the nightmare and he is the aide. And he initially said, I'll help you where I can. As soon as they get a solid footing on the case, he suddenly can't help them anymore. And what does he say to them in this chapter? I don't like the phones. I like to correspond by mail.
I'm a letter person.
And how has the killer reached out to them so far?
Letters.
By letter.
I know. There's nothing solid. It's not like they have his fingerprints on it, but it really is starting to point at Jacob.
If that was an imposter nightmare, the only person who knows the nightmare well enough probably to impersonate him, who was there that night and who drove the undetectables there and would have a reason to fool them, is Jacob.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily have a motive.
Not a clear one.
And we also can't account for his whereabouts on October 2nd or on the night of the murder at the club. We know that he had visited the undetectables earlier the day of the murder at the club, but he disappeared shortly thereafter with a very flimsy excuse.
It's flimsy now, in retrospect. At the time, he's like, I've got plans.
And then showed up later.
Not a big deal, right?
And then showed up later with the nightmare.
Well, again, a lot of people showed up.
Yeah.
It was a murder.
He's not mentioned as having been with the nightmare at the party at the hotel either.
Nope.
Because he's the nightmare's aide. And the nightmare is someone who can't get around without his itinerary, apparently.
Yeah.
Cornelia says that this chapter.
That's
so
true.
So interesting. Now, Jacob is a little below notice. It might just be like assumed that he was there without it being stated.
Yeah.
But he hasn't been specifically mentioned to have been there.
It's true.
I think Jacob is our killer, now more than ever, to the point where I am confidently accusing him of being our serial killer. He is the Whistler. He is using a deadly knife of enchanted deadly death to commit his murders.
Mm-hmm.
He used a ring of disguise to impersonate the nightmare to hire the undetectables. And he is either trying to frame up the nightmare for whatever reason, or is trying to just muddy up the investigation by having a bunch of amateurs run roughshod over the official investigation in order to delay things long enough for him to complete his ritual. I would not be surprised.
That also tracks.
I would not be surprised if the CCTV footage shows up footage of the nightmare at the club that night.
It very well might.
But wearing that big gaudy green ring.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. It's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. But that's where I'm at.
I know. The case is building. I would not say it's rock solid, but it's certainly building.
Yeah.
A lot of things are starting to point.
Jacob's the killer.
Yes, that's what they're pointing at.
I am completely convinced. I am happy to be wrong,
well,
as always.
There's still
plenty of book left.
Yeah, we still have a little less than half a book left. Lots could happen. We'll see.
I don't think it's Van Doren.
We've been right before. We've been wrong before.
It's true.
Many times.
I don't think it's Van Doren. I don't know enough about Gray Quinn to say for sure. I don't believe that it's O'Sullivan. No. I think that's flimsy. And I think Beckett is just a harmless idiot.
It kind of looks that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, obviously, I think Gray Quinn is up to something shady.
Oh, no.
For sure. Quinn, I just don't think it's murder.
Gray Quinn and the Nightmare are 1,000% up to some shady business, but that doesn't equal evil ritual of murdery death.
Yeah, exactly.
That could plunge the world into chaos. Like, that doesn't add up to that.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, I think O'Sullivan's being cagey because she's got a point to make and something to prove and a chip on her shoulder.
We don't actually know who O'Sullivan talked to.
No.
On her phone call, if she actually spoke to the Nightmare or maybe just his office being Jacob.
Because they only heard her part of the conversation and they're like, he might have just berated her until she just was like, fine, I'm done with this conversation and came back to talk to us.
Entirely possible.
Or it's possible the call was intercepted because who'd be taking the Nightmare's calls?
Jacob. Yep. It's all possible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's where we're at.
Well, that's
kind of where the chapter ends too, right? Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
So there you go. An official accusation for the first time in this book.
You did it.
Very confident. But we'll have to wait and see. Perhaps we'll find out more. Perhaps I'll be proven dead wrong as
Maybe.
We move into chapter 19 of The Undetectables, which you'll want to read up on in time for next week.
Yes.
In the meantime, of course, as always, you can give us a little rating and review.
We always appreciate those. They're very nice.
Yes. You can also reach out to us on social media.
Oh my goodness. We have a whole list. We are on Instagram, Facebook, X, Blue Sky, and Goodreads. We are at The Read Along on any of them that need an at.
Indeed. You can also send us an email.
Oh, please do. We'd like one of those. We are thereadalong@gmail.com.
And with that said, as always, we love you very much, and we'll see you next time.
I'm going to dust some more here in the accusing part.
Thank you for joining us on The Read-Along with your hosts, Anita and Scott Bourgeois. All Read-Along music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Cover art is by Aaron Beaver. Be sure to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Read-Along, and check out our group on Goodreads.com.